the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. Coming up on today's podcast, we have an interview with David Cromer and Jason Loweth from The Adding Machine by Next Theater Company. They will be talking to Ann Nicholson Weber about the show, and of course, you don't want to miss this interview. Also, we have an audio review of Oklahoma, and of course, as always, Chicago's theater news. So sit back and relax, and get ready to talk some theater.
You're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm your host for this week's segment, Ann Nicholson Weber. And I'm here today with David Cromer and Jason Loweth. Jason is the artistic director at Next Theater, which is producing the show we're going to be talking about, a musical version of The Adding Machine. And David Cromer is directing the production. Jason and David, welcome.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
I thought we might start at the very beginning, and I believe Jason was the one who was there at the inception of this show. Can you tell us where this came from?
Yes, it was about 1992, 93. I was, at the time, my eyes were being opened to opera, the world of alternative opera. I was dating somebody who worked at the Long Beach Opera, which is a very interesting Southern California company that does interesting reimaginations of the classic repertoire. So I was getting into a lot of opera, and I also, for one reason or another, somebody had given me a copy of Elmer Rice's plays. I think it was actually I had been introduced to Street Scene, his piece that was turned into an opera or musical, depending on who you ask, by Kurt Weill with lyrics by Langston Hughes. And so I said, oh my God, I love this Street Scene. I think this is fantastic. I'd like to learn more about his work. And so I started reading Elmer Rice's other plays, Dream Girls, Counselor at Law, and then I read The Adding Machine, and I'm reading this first scene, which is a four-page monologue of Mrs. Zero at night in bed with Mr. Zero, her husband, berating him for not being a good breadwinner, for never having the price, and it goes on and on for four pages. And, you know, I like Westerns. Don't you like those Westerns? I love those Westerns. I was saying to Mrs. 12 the other day how much I like the Westerns. And I also like the, you know, love songs. I love the old love stories, and I think they're fantastic. And on it goes on and on. And as I'm reading it, I'm thinking to myself, my God, this is just like Mozart's Queen of the Night aria from The Magic Flute. You know, that goes... And I thought, this should be an opera. This should be a small chamber opera. And that's what started. And I was living in Los Angeles, and I immediately started trying to find a composer, and I found this horribly schlocky film composer who just wrote some of the worst music you've ever heard.
I won't ask you his name.
I won't tell you. So I put it on the shelf for a while as an idea because this was not going to be a good partnership. And then I lived in New York for 5 years, and I talked to another composer, a real sort of show tunesy kind of guy, who was trying to turn it into MAME or something, and that wasn't right.
And so M-A-I-M?
Yes, yeah. M-A-I-M is what it was turning out to be. And it wasn't until I was working at Next Theater Company back, I guess 3 years ago, we did a production of Far Away by Carol Churchill, and Josh Schmidt, our composer, was the sound designer and composer for that production. I had seen his work or heard his work at Writers Theater, where he did an amazing, amazing Crime and Punishment, which was adapted by Kurt Columbus, I think it was. And his work was just wonderful. And so while we were working on Far Away, I thought, I'm a little simpatico with this guy. And I gave him a copy of The Adding Machine. And he said, absolutely. And he understood it. And for the first time, I was on the same page with somebody artistically in, you know, what at that point it had been 11 years.
Can you characterize the sensibility that he had that made him write for this?
I think Mr. Cromer, Mr. Schmidt, and myself are all sort of morose beings in a way.
Yeah.
We sort of all come from, you know, we all could use the antidepressants.
Yeah, you read The Adding Machine and go like, I knew it.
Exactly.
This is what it was really like.
I think there was – honestly, I think there was a part of that is a huge – I think that's why it works for the three of us, because we can look at a story that a lot of people find as bleak and locate this tiny sliver of hope in it and find a musical to write all around that tiny sliver. Actually, David at our first rehearsal spoke beautifully about that.
About what did
concrete
I say?
Weeds. Remember?
Oh yeah. Well, I just you know, like the when people would say, it's funny because the language, the choice of words is really important in terms of presenting this thing. Because if you say there's something about the phrase, it's the Adding Machine, the musical. You know, it's a musical version of the Adding Machine. It sounds like you're going to, if you know the Adding Machine at all, it sounds like you're going to. Like it's going to be Little Shop of Horrors, you know, or something, that it's somehow going to be
campy
or just
fun.
or brightened up, or just mm-hmm. like it's a crazy workplace comedy, or mm-hmm. I don't know what it just sounds kind of wrong. So there's something about the language, and so I was always really aware of that it's a, you know, I was going to jump back and say I was thinking about your question about Josh, and the thing I was just sort of answering it for myself, what makes Josh the right guy for this, and it's because he is utterly and completely dead serious about everything all the time, and utterly and completely silly about everything all the time. I understand that makes 200% of a person, but like I think that's actually the case. He's like both completely humorless and hilarious.
Uh-huh. That's,
you know what I mean?
Hard and to picture. That,
you know?
Absolutely.
Well, but it's a semi-valid description of judgment.
Uh-huh.
One of the smartest composers, one of the most intellectually based composers you've ever met, who can manage to take what he knows and apply it with humor to a piece. Nobody would have – I don't know who would have thought of putting sort of tunes that are reminiscent of gospel and Burt Bacharach into the same scene and make it work. But he does, because he can – write fluidly in all those different media.
Well, actually, that was going to be my next question, that you both of you have answered my question about him in terms of his temperament and sort of personality. But I would have thought that there would be something in his musical language that you responded to or were looking for. And yet it would be hard from this piece to say what his musical personality is, because it's so varied throughout the piece.
I have to say, after our second preview, I suddenly thought, oh my God, this is all one single unified voice.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course,
I didn't quite realize it, how well it was. And I think back to the Crime and Punishment that I saw, and the same holds true for that as does for the Adding Machine. And it's what actually the Variety review said. The music and the scenes flow so beautifully one into the other,
mm-hmm.
seamlessly, in a way that somebody like Josh, who has been a sound designer for theater most of his professional career, he understands how sound needs to work with dramaturgy in a way that can both assert itself at the right times and underplay it at the right times. And I think that's part of what makes his accomplishment here so stunning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the sort of the style of any world is its extremes all put next to each other, and then it becomes one thing. So I sort of think that's the other thing about Josh. He can write incredibly whimsical music and incredibly serious music from one second to the one moment to the next, and that is sort of the Adding Machine, which is again why I think he's appropriate, you know, and that it is about relentlessly serious things. And I want to say that, you know, humor is really tricky with this, which is I think it's very, very funny, mm-hmm. or I think the play's funny. I won't try to
the audience thought
my
so
own
too.
Production, yeah, but in an incredibly bleak way,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. and so I always thought that was the other thing that is the language of the play is everything from I can't speak about it musically, so I'm going to sound very dumb, but there's music at the very end of Mr. Zero's aria in the court. And I guess it's not an aria if people are singing with him, but in the courtroom where the music is so incredibly low, it's too low to sing. The piano is just going boom, 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 boom under him. And it's so just the depths of this guy. And Joel Hatch is really wonderful. It's just this guy said, I just with his hands out going, I don't know what I just did. And that's so heart-wrenching. And then there'll be something really, really silly and almost poppy the next moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because that's the way the world operates. You know what I mean? It can be if you look at it a certain way. The joke on the design team is a half-empty glass is the least of our worries, you know, the production team. that it's so grounded and rumbly, and then you know, and then we fill our lives with sort of froth or something pretty or a cute song or, you know, to sort of compensate, you know. And I don't know which of those is real. They both are.
Both, right.
And I guess that's why I really agree. It's like it all started to come together for me. Combined with, and I would also just characterize something that you and he have always explained to me constantly as we went along, which is, and I would never think of it this way, which is that the Adding Machine, the play varies wildly in style.
Yes.
And so they wanted the music, at least in the initial phases, to vary wildly in style. One of the best things you can do, one of the most honorable things you can do as any kind of theater artist is give up your own voice for the voice of the play. So while on some level you can recognize Josh's style in this, on another level you can say, he's just doing what the Adding Machine tells him to do.
He's channeling Elmer Rice.
Yeah, he's doing what he thinks the Adding Machine is telling him to do. I don't know if you agree with that. But and so that's the style of the piece, which is it's all the kitchen sink stuff that Rice has thrown into, you know.
Well, before we leave that, because I do want to get to talk a little bit about the development process, but it's a very strange, strong flavor, this text. I mean, it's just not like anything you've tasted. And I wonder how either of you might characterize it for people who haven't seen it and who have no idea what we're talking about. What is this style, this expressionist style? What characterizes it?
Well, expressionism, you know, think about Edvard Munch's The Scream, that wonderful painting from the late 1800s, in which the painter uses the brush strokes, the strange shape of the figure to convey the inner or express the inner emotional value of that character. If you think about expressionism, if that's expressionism in a nutshell in visual arts, in terms of theater, expressionism is altering the theatricality of the performance to better express the inner emotional state of the character. Here, of course, we are told by Elmer Rice very clearly, Mr. Zero is our main character, and the entire world is constructed around him as a way to express his inner thoughts, his inner life. I think Josh has done an amazing job by musicalizing those inner voices as a chorus, which is something that we had talked about early on. This would be the way to do that, make Mr. One and Mr. Two and Mrs. One and Mr. Two into this chorus that are like a Greek chorus, but really speak from inside him, within him. So you get them sort of reinforcing Mrs. Zero's aria in the first act. So I guess for somebody who's not seen The Adding Machine, a chamber musical, I think the best way we could explain it would be it's a real journey into the mind of this character through song and great theatricality, which is why David is the perfect partner for it. I mean, we had the theatricality of the music that Josh has already layered in, on top of which David has layered in an incredibly faithful theatricality in terms of direction and design.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would like to just take a minute to talk about the design, because to me that was one of the really stunning things about the production is the way it looks and sounds.
Matt said one of the great things Matt York said at one point, sort of in the middle of the design process, he just went, it's just got to be cool.
Uh-huh.
Because
uh-huh.
it's got to be cooler. That was our model. It had to be cool.
What did you say at the first design meeting? How did you characterize what it was you were asking for from them?
I think I said something like,
you talked about the extremes. The same way the music functions, in that you go to the Elysian Fields, which is a whole, it needs to be a completely different visual gesture. And you talked about the same way there were musical gestures, that there were visual gestures within each scene, which you accomplished incredibly well.
I think we were, I think we looked at like maybe what expressionism means. I'm bad with isms. It's a little silly thing to say, but you know, it's like, I feel like I don't understand categories very well. But yeah, we wanted things that were normal, like the bed, but we wanted to look at it in an odd way. Mm-hmm. I knew that was just something I had in my head, and I we did a talk back last week, and you know, the bed was, you know, everyone worked really hard on the bed, and like there was a lot of details to it, and it kept wanting to look sort of realer and more sort of believable from all angles as a bed, and I just busted everybody's chops about it endlessly, and someone finally in a talk back the other day asked, now why did you have the bed tipped up? And I couldn't possibly, I just said, because I thought it would be cool. You know?
Right.
Matt York said it should be cool.
It was cool.
Yeah. And I think I guess one thing we knew about the visual was that I really wanted every scene to look completely different, because in The Rice, it's just, you know, scene in the, it switches locations. In The Rice, it's 9 scenes. Is that correct?
You're saying in The Rice?
In The Rice play, in the Elmer Rice play. That's our term for just in the play, in mm-hmm. The Rice. Mm-hmm. Version of the adding the non-musical,
right?
So yeah, we wanted every scene to look very different, and then the big gesture we realize is that every single scene takes place indoors, except for the Elysian Fields, right. Which then led Christine Kananishu, the costume designer, because we just sort of all brainstormed in the first couple of meetings. She said, you know, I just keep thinking that this is always, I think of every scene as in the basement. She said, like, I think that the office scene is the accountants are kept in the basement of the store. So then we started thinking that what if the Zeros lived in a basement apartment, and what if, you know, that he was in a, you know, underground. And so that led Matthew York to create this one little garden, that one little casement window up in the wall that's used in every scene to right. tell you that you're always
still underground
right. you know, and that the Elysian Fields is suddenly outdoors.
Oh, it's so dramatic.
And then we had all this room, and then we wanted to cramp the, like, we have the set always very, very close to the edge of the stage to keep it. So those were the initial ideas. I just wanted everyone to look very unfortunate. Like every choice they had made was ugly. Like that dress doesn't fit right, and that mm-hmm. this light is unattractive on everybody. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I just and this was the pouring cement on the flowers thing, which is just that we wanted it to. I just was always insisting that it just looked like relentlessly bleak, which is not. Cheerful to hear from your director. Designers don't like to do it. Artistic directors, I think, don't like to hear it. It's like, yeah, we're going to take all the laughs and any possible joy out of it. You know, we're just going to bleach it right out. But that was so that when a little tiny ray of hope appeared, you really, really mm-hmm. noticed it.
Mm-hmm. Like coming down from the dungeon window with the dust motes in it.
Yeah, as opposed to just sort of leaping back and forth. Don't worry, everything's going to be okay, because
it isn't in the end. Yeah.
Well, or is it?
We had a great headline after somebody talked to David Cromer that said something like, "The bleak reality of zero hope." I thought, oh, yeah. God, no one will come. So I kept being the flower and he kept being the concrete, you know, trying to push through. Yeah.
I would like to talk a little bit about the adaptation process. So, Jason, going back to, you know, you found your composer, and then how do you go about making a musical out of, or an opera, depending on how you categorize it, out of a play?
It was a really wonderful collaboration. We made some early decisions about structure and theme, the creation of the chorus, the idea that the authority figure throughout the play would be non-singing, which became more and more significant as we explored. And we also made the decision early on – we weren't sure how exactly the show was going to end, but we made the decision early on to bring back Daisy. In the original play, when Mr. Zero is confronted with the soul machine, the fixer, this otherworldly figure, tries to get him to go back and basically makes up this beautiful woman off in the wing, says, "There's a beautiful woman over there, Zero. Her name is Hope. Why don't you go after her?" And he even like throws his voice. So Zero goes off after Hope, which I knew, because I'm the flower and David's the concrete, was not going to do for this adaptation. I didn't want it to be quite so nihilistic, mm-hmm. like, you know, humanity chases hope, but it's an empty promise. I didn't want to say that. We had, you know, I've learned a lot in producing, and that's a very tough thing for people to hear when they come see a play. So we wanted to make it much more ambiguous. And by tying up the romantic story with Daisy, by having them meet not only in the 6th scene, but in the 7th mm-hmm. scene, the final scene. So that was a major those were the major structural decisions we made. After that, Josh went away and he came back with, as David was saying, the extremes. He came back with Mrs. Zero's aria and scene six, which is the Elysian Fields, the two polar opposites musically in the play. One, almost a cloyingly sweet Rodgers and Hart sounding scene, close to a book musical, and the other much more operatic, much more Mrs. Zero's aria. I'm not allowed to call it dissonant because it's not technically dissonant, and Josh can tell you why it's not technically dissonant, but it's certainly music that is less
nagging.
Pleasant to the
right.
ear and
right.
sounds like a woman nagging right. her husband or anybody nagging anyone else.
Right. Right.
And so we knew immediately when he brought that back in, these are the poles.
Well, now I imagine you have to cut a lot of text to make room for music.
We did cut a lot of text. We did cut a lot of text, and that was we cut a lot of text. That was frankly easy, and we added more text. We created text in places to help hammer in our themes and what we were talking about. The rapprochement between Mr. Zero and Mrs. Zero in the prison, which culminates in the Didn't We song, is all new because we wanted it to be less bleak mm-hmm. and an opportunity for humor. Sherd Lou, who is this character we discover in the jail in this production, does not get discovered in the jail. We wanted to greatly expand his role because he stands for a prim morality that ultimately undoes Mr. Zero. And we created the In Numbers aria, which repeats again and again and again to help show Mr. Zero's inner life, which is to say it's an uncomplicated one, but one in which he relies on – it's easier for him to rely on numbers than the real world.
And I also always interpreted that idea as it's Willy Loman-like, and it's a man who chooses to believe in a system he's presented with. Mm-hmm. Assuming that it will eventually reward yeah. him.
That's excellent. We wanted to very much, I think when this play was written in 1923, it was very clearly sort of an anti-capitalist screed about the rise of industrialism and the dehumanization of people in the face of technology, so on and so forth. I thought that was too easy of an out in 2006 or 2007. So we wanted to make Mr. Zero shoulder some amount of the blame mm-hmm. in choosing the machine himself. So we added a lot of lines to that effect.
Well, is there something that distinguishes a play that can successfully be adapted to a musical? Is there some quality or some way you can characterize what makes it possible to musicalize a play?
Well, I would say that the only thing about the adding machine that makes anyone sometimes say really a musical of that is simply because it's not very peppy or positive in its story. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it actually is one of sort of the most perfect things to make into a musical as far as I'm concerned, because it is already based in reality with a very, very, frankly, subtle tweak into unreality.
Right.
Which is that while people are numbered, and that's very sort of stylized, and, you know, and he's called Mr. Zero, and that could be seen as very literal, the conversations are actually kind of real. They're mundane. They're based on real conversation. I mean, they're entertainingly mundane. They're sort of – the people are sort of not always very imaginative in their conversation. And one of the things Rice was writing about was kind of certain aspects of everyday life that can be a little repetitive and a little, you know, and a little thwarting. But I think it almost lends itself more naturally to being sung. I mean, expressionism, if it's a heightening of what's already there, right. if it's an expressing visually, orally, physically of what's already there, particularly emotionally, the next logical step is to sing.
To musicalize.
That's what musicals
right.
do.
Yeah.
And that's why
right.
and that's exactly why you've got Spring Awakening, which is now a rock musical on Broadway. Why Wedekind's Lulu, another expressionistic classic, was turned into an opera. Mm-hmm. You could easily see, I think one could see The Emperor Jones, if the O'Neill Estate would let you, turn that into an opera of sorts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. So, yeah, that makes sense that there's something in this style because of the heightened, it's not actually heightened language, but it's heightened reality
yeah.
that lends itself very comfortably to what is obviously a very unrealistic situation of people singing instead of talking.
And the form demands in expressionism that you go from one's outer external world to one's internal world nearly seamlessly in the form of those plays.
Right.
And that's what musicals do. Right, they go from external to internal.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I guess I'd like to just wrap up by asking you, Jason, what made you think that David was the right person to collaborate with on this piece?
In addition to being as morose as Josh and me, surprisingly, stunningly, all the humor that you saw in the show, and there is a great deal of it, comes straight from David. He did an amazing job making that flower grow between the cracks of concrete. I don't think I was aware what an amazing job he would do until it was that Saturday Night Preview, and I turned to him and I said, "Oh my God, we've got a dark comedy on our hands." And he said, "Oh, you didn't know that?" Of course. Uh-huh. On top of which, visually, you know, Keith Parham and Matt York, who David had never worked with, they were veterans of the space, and I thought, for this ambitious piece, we're going to need people who already know the space. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. David pushed them in ways they had never been pushed, and that space visually transformed. And I knew it was after the workshop presentation we did 2 years ago, and I sat down with David, and he first sketched out his idea for the bed upended. And I said, he has the visual understanding to gel with this emotional and oral world. And we were lucky.
You were right. Well, it's a very interesting and impressive collaboration, as I think most people are saying, and I'm really thrilled to have had a chance to talk to you guys about it. Thanks so much. So The Adding Machine is showing at Next. How long?
We've extended to March 4th.
Great, great. Well, good luck, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anne.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another effusive episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Mote, bringing you the theater news for the week of February 19th, 2007. The Chicago Company of Wicked will soon be offering a rare glimpse into the wings of the musical. The exclusive behind-the-scenes look, called Behind the Emerald Curtain, is hosted by the cast members of the Chicago Company of Wicked. The tours will be offered to the public starting on March 6th, and that will be every Tuesday evening, starting at 5 o'clock. This, of course, all takes place at the Ford Center for the Performing Arts, also known as the Oriental Theater. Participants will get a chance to visit the exclusive Behind the Emerald Curtain Museum, which will include a set model by the designer Eugene Lee. And these Tuesday tours, which are reported to last about an hour, will conclude with a question and answer session with the cast members. So remember, that's Behind the Emerald Curtain Tours, offered every Tuesday at 5 o'clock, and that will be starting on March 6th. For more information, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Massacre, Sing to Your Children, which is a dark comic thriller by Jose Rivera, will be making its world premiere in a Teatro Vista production in association with the Goodman Theater. The cast of Massacre, Sing to Your Children is set to include Teatro Vista's artistic director Edward Torres and also ensemble members Sandra Delgado, Sandra Marquez, Joe Minoso, and Juan Francisco Villa. Jose Rivera, who received 2 Obie Awards for playwriting, wrote Massacre, Sing to Your Children, by being commissioned by the Labyrinth Theater Company, and he held a staged reading of it back in the New York Public Theater. Well, now its world premiere will be a part of the Teatro Vista's 15th anniversary season here in Chicago. So Massacre will open on March 24th at the Owen Theater, which is, of course, in the Goodman Theater. Well, the Raven Theater is going to be presenting The Seagull by Anton Chekhov, and this is a classic you definitely don't want to miss. The show will be directed by Michael Menendian, who you may remember from a past interview here at Talk Theater in Chicago. Chekhov's The Seagull will be opening on Sunday, March 25th at the Raven Theater, which is located at 6157 North Clark Street. For more information and for a question and answer session with Michael Menendian, click on over to Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Well, thank you for listening to this effusive episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before we let you go, you know it is time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote comes from The Two Gentlemen of Verona, Act 3, Scene 1. The fashion of time is changed. Thank you very much for listening. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So, until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it. You are listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago Review Podcast. The following is a review of Oklahoma at the American Theater Company in Chicago. Music by Richard Rogers, books and lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein II, and directed by Damon Kiley. Review by Tom Williams. American Theater Company's Damon Kiley has reinvented the old chestnut, Oklahoma, from a slick Broadway show into a gritty, no-fringe, and folksy chamber piece. The result is an Oklahoma with hearts and grassroots wholesomeness. Oklahoma is reborn in a picnic western musical to a darker, more realistic, and grittier place. The use of a minimal set consisting of a covered wagon that unfolds into a front porch of a farmhouse, together with loads of wooden barrels, set design was by Jacqueline and Richard Penrod, and four folk-slash-country string acoustic musicians gave this Oklahoma a down-home country tone. The folk band included terrific work from Mike Prisgoda on banjo, Scott Sedlicek on guitar, Cody Siragusa on bass, and Billy O on fiddle. Under the direction of Malcolm Rule, an experienced chamber arranger, Richard Rogers' score sounded enchanting and quaint. This string folk sound worked surprisingly well. American Theater Company's intimate stage allowed the all-natural musical and vocals to be enjoyed without amplification. Director Damon Kiley's decision to have us connect with Oklahoma by casting only 12 players, with the principals being actors who can sing, with the emphasis on acting first. The folksy style and deft use of the Oklahoma slang speech allowed for more grassroots character development. We see the characters as teenagers struggling to find their soulmates in rural 1901 Indian Territory, which will of course soon be the state of Oklahoma. Matthew Brumlow plays Curly, a cocky and sassy guy steeped into his cowboy macho. His Curly has depth, swagger, and loads of charm. Brumlow sells his songs from the heart, making his unpolished singing sound more like a sincere cowpoke than a Broadway leading man, and that's a plus. Katie Jeep also plays Lori as a rural farm girl, shy, but totally in love with the brash Curly. We like these two love-struck teens. The terrific work from Susan Petrie as Aunt Eller really anchors the show. She is always in command. This production allows Hammerstein's funny book to dominate over the songs, and you will not see a finer acted Oklahoma than this warmly personal production. Ali Renee Greaves' period-perfect costumes add realism, as does all the dirty faces. Casey Campbell's Will Parker is winning, as he clearly gives Parker's denseness a cute turn. Caitlin Carlson almost steals the show with her frisky and sensual Ado Annie. Kareem Bandili's Ali Hakim was a hoot. And I was impressed by Marty Higginbotham's strong work and fine vocals playing the eerie villain Judd Fry. This cast of 12 sings, dances, and acts their role with spirited sense of community. The dream sequence has some clever and refreshingly new twists that worked extremely well. The singing reminded me of a folk concert or a group of rural folks serenading around a campfire. We see the love between Curly and Lori, and between Parker and Ado Annie develop in strong and several cute scenes. The Rogers score is effectively delivered where the meanings and the moods win over the rich voices. The tunes sounded like real folks singing from their hearts. Songs like I Can't Say No and All or Nothing show Caitlin Carlson's talent. Brumlow and Jeep give a richly romantic twist to People Will Say We're in Love. The essence of what it means to be an American in the West in 1901 comes across marvelously in this effective and enjoyable production. The rousing anthem Oklahoma celebrates the sense of community in the heartland. We see the headstrong and proud teen lovers, the communal cooperation as well as the farmer versus the cowboy feud, strong bonds of friendship, and the shared joys of weddings bring hope for a bright future to all. Oklahoma is indeed Rodgers and Hammerstein's celebration of the American rural experience. And this folksy, scaled-down production is a well-thought-out piece that strips Oklahoma down to its basics without sacrificing the brilliant songs or the nostalgic feel. Damon Kiley's direction is visionary. He proves that classics can be reduced without the loss of heart. Again, less can often be more. So come and rediscover Oklahoma, the people's folk operetta. You'll be glad you did, and you'll still leave the theater humming the melodies. This show is, of course, highly recommended. Oklahoma is by American Theater Company, located at 1909 West Byron Avenue in Chicago, Illinois. The running time is about 2 hours and 30 minutes with one intermission, and the show will be running through March 4th. So for more information, call 773-929-1031. Again, that's 773-929-1031. Thank you very much for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank David Cromer and Jason Loweth for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer, without whom this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Thank you for listening every week. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for you. So, until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.